Hello and welcome to Little Fictions on Air. I'm Kate Liston-Mills, your host. The title of today's story is Saint Vladimir and is written by acclaimed author Tanya Vavilova. You may recall that we listened to another of Tanya's stories titled Artichoke Hearts in August this year. Saint Vladimir can also be found in Tanya's short story collection Grub, which won the 2019 Carmel Bird Digital Literary Award and was published the same year by Spineless Wonders. Today's story, Saint Vladimir, takes place in the not-too-distant future, where humans are experiencing the fallout of an environmental crisis. This crisis has a series of effects including homelessness, violence, and uncertainty of food and water resources. The story also skillfully weaves gender differences into its characters, which I think reflect the world of the future. Tanya explores intergenerational themes in her stories as well as intersexuality. Her work often explores trauma, mental illness, as well as stories which connect her with her family in Moscow. The humour depicted in Saint Vladimir enables its difficult themes to be narrated in a way that doesn't seem to be too disheartening, as well as giving the characters hope in their otherwise bleak world. These themes are interesting to consider while listening to the story, and I hope you enjoy it. Saint Vladimir is performed by Mark Desai.
Girl, you want to catch a cold? I look at him blankly. Get off that porch. It's okay, I tell him. Sergei is stuck in the old country. He has a terrific fear of cold surfaces, ice cubes, and wet hair. Sergei, I say, we have enough to worry about here, what with leptospirosis carrying rats. Remember poor Charlie in Redfern? He walks away at that, leaving me on the stoop with the groceries. I unwrap a chupa chup and suck on it thoughtfully. I've been hoarding lollies for years. Charlie died of kidney failure after a giant rat cornered him in the kitchen and bit a hunk out of his ankle. It's all the neighbours talked about until a day-glow spider straddled Kim's baby. But that's another story. I'm still thinking of Sergei when I get up, my knees creaking like rusty hinges, and make my way home. The bare trees loom above me, making arches against the chrome sky. I pass the children's hospital on the corner, a white rectangular building with prams parked out the front. A kid wails from the top floor. A mum in a beanie leans against the wall and eyes me suspiciously. Her child is probably dying of dysentery. I walk past. Dandelions grow on the sidewalk, grey and fluffy, seeds ready to fly off and germinate, ever hopeful. The street is almost empty, except for some young hoods on skateboards. They eye my raggedy coat and let me be. Everyone is just trying to make a buck. Without Ari, I don't know what would have happened to me. No, that's not true. I do know. I would have ended up in a baby factory. It's a way for the desperate to be housed, fed, and clothed. I turn the corner, and here we are. Home. My habitation could not really be called a flat. I mean, it wouldn't appear on realestate.com or anything. I live in the basement of an abandoned Russian Orthodox church, St. Vladimir's. The dude who brought Christianity to the Kievan Rus, and later minted coins and imported wine, so yeah, my people like him a lot. I pull open the tiny timber door and prop myself on the ledge, then push myself feet first into the cramped space. The dust motes rise about my boots. Ari will be back soon, and I want to make sure dinner's ready. We are a post-gender couple, but you know what? I'm the better cook. One time, Ari served up death caps on toast. It was appalling. After a few false starts, I get the wood stove going. The veggie sausages are bobbing in the little pot. The label on the can says, classic vegetarian sausages in gravy, though what's classic about it still eludes me. We found these ones in the kitchen of an abandoned boarding house. At least the stove is hot. The flame licking the sides of the copper pot. It hasn't risen above 10 degrees in weeks. This basement is dank and overgrown. Vines creep through cracks in the plaster, making green barbed wire nests in corners. Under the glow of the oil lamp, you can just make out the creepy crawlies between the pots and pans. I hear Ari climb through the window as I'm ladling the sausages. "Perfect timing," Ari says by way of greeting. "Vegetarian sausage. Again? What did you expect? Shepherd's pie and a nice garden salad?" Ari sighs. It's hard to keep upbeat when the world's ending. We hunch over the steaming bowls in silence. I'm chewing on a carrot or potato. It's hard to tell because every vegetable in the can is round and brown. All of a sudden, I drop my knife. Ari watches me. "All right. What's that mean?" I sigh. "It means," I say, "we'll have a visitor, a male visitor." "You don't really believe that, do you?" There are soup flecks on Ari's face. I don't say anything because what's the point? Neither of us have jobs to go to anymore, or anyone to impress. We smell like pubescent boys after little athletics. "You want some more?" I ask before turning away to do the washing up. Afterwards, we climb the stairs, go through the trapdoor, and emerge into the bowels of the old church. The light is hazy, heavenly, almost silver. I think about commenting on this, but can't formulate the right words. There are fewer pews now than when we first moved in. We use about a pew a week for firewood. I came here when we were growing up, with my parents and brothers. I imagine I can still smell the incense from the priest's golden thurible, curls of sweet-smelling smoke. The iconostasis has been stripped bare. After the last economic downturn, the icons were pilfered and sold on eBay for a fraction of their real worth. Some of them dated from the 16th century. "Is it time for another pew?" Ari asks me. "Yeah." I breathe all the air out of my lungs. "You still feeling bad about it?" "Yeah," I admit. "Stupid, huh?" "Why don't we grab a small pew today?" We push the old oak bench out the door and carry it around to the basement window. "Where's the axe?" "Behind the crapper," Ari answers. "Do you have to call it the crapper?" "Oh, that's right. I forgot we were referring to the pit by the fence as the powder room. My apologies." I can't help but smile. We take turns smashing the old oak, our breath hot and misty in the night. Later, I'm standing in the basement and Ari passes the lumber to me through the window, telling me to be careful. "Of course I'm careful," I say. We chose this place initially because it has a functioning fireplace, rare these days. I think fondly of the years of electric heaters and reverse cycle aircon, the dry heat, the ease, everything pre-programmed and predictable. We know we are lucky to have a roof and four walls. I watch as Ari gets the newspaper and twigs smoking. They smile at me. "Where are the sleeping bags, pet?" I drag our deflated nylon caterpillars to the fireplace, get as close as possible to the heat. The orange flames are rising and licking the ancient oak. It feels sacrificial, burning those pews. Not that I'm religious or anything, not for a long time. Ari curls their body around mine. We are two spoons in a Hello Kitty sleeping bag. I'm too tired to be embarrassed by how far we've sunk. The fire. The fire, the fire. "I love you, pet," Ari whispers, as I drift off to a troubled sleep. When I wake, Ari is gone. We like to say, to work. What they really do, I have no idea. I respect their need for secrets. Meow Meow is stretched along the window ledge. She likes to catch the morning sun, warm her tiger stripes. "Hello," I say. "Hello, little cat." She waves her pink paw pads at me. I'm distracted, worried about running out of church pews. If only we'd squatted in a Catholic or Protestant church. Those folks had a pew for everyone. I watch Meow Meow arc across the floor, land on my sleeping bag, her pink nose twitching at the air. "Hello," I say again. She rubs her flank against me and we meow at each other. She just arrived one day, wet and mangy, just like us, and Ari had said, well, why not? She's our fur baby now. The accusation slung at millennials fulfilled. Selfish, childless, homeless, jobless, penniless, dog and cat crazy. She turns a green eye towards me. "What's wrong?" I say. "You're cold, huh?" She wriggles under my woolen jumper and settles somewhere above my navel, a living hot water bottle with fleas. I throw more lumber onto the fire and stay in bed reading Cancer Ward as Meow Meow kneads my stomach. She purrs gently and, at some point, I nod off. In the early evening, Ari returns triumphant. They have gleaned some hospital blankets for us, you know, those white waffle ones, and some instant coffee. If you're not squeamish, there's stuff to be found in old nursing homes and hospitals. "Where'd you get those?" I ask. "You want coffee or not?" I nod gratefully. We read our books and drink Makona, ensconced in our own private worlds. Mine is the aftermath of Stalin's great purge. Meow Meow splits her time equally between us, jumping from my lap to Ari's, then back to mine. When the sun sets, Ari gets up and turns on the torches and solar-powered lights. The globes blink on and off, a lonely school disco. Eventually, I pull myself up to brush my teeth. Sloshing the rainwater around my mouth, I think of gingivitis before spitting out the window. Someone moves in the dark. My heart thumps. "Who's out there?" I hiss. Silence. "Sergey, is that you?" "Yeah," he says. "What are you doing out there? I saw smoke coming out your chimney. I'm cold, Shell." Since government officials took over the terraces, it's been even harder to find a good squat. "All right, you idiot," I say. "Come in then." Sergey clambers through the window, thick legs first, and lands sprawled on all fours. Meow Meow slinks forward and sniffs him suspiciously. "It's all right, cat," I whisper. Sergey is complaining of the cold when Ari saunters in from the powder room in the nude. "Ah!" says Sergey. "Who's this then?" Ari asks, looking at me. "This is Sergey, from the old country." I'd spoken about him before. "Welcome," Ari says, "to the basement of Vladimir's Russian Orthodox Church, a late 20th century marvel, all weatherboard and mold." Sergey is staring at Ari's crotch. "This is a sacrilege," he says. "Church or crotch?" Ari says, noticing the special attention. Sergey appeals to me. "You want somewhere warm to stay or not?" I ask. He turns his back to us and mumbles something to Jesus. We watch from a respectful distance. "Okay, I will stay," Sergey announces. "Fine." I set him up on a pile of cardboard boxes by the fire and give him a hospital blanket to keep warm. He prays quietly in the dark. When he drops off to sleep, Ari gets into my sleeping bag and we curl our limbs around each other like animals in a David Attenborough doco. I am dreaming about my father's collection of icons when I hear a scream. Sergey is standing above us with a pickaxe. "What the hell are you doing?" Ari yells. "Put that goddamn axe down." "Sergey," I say. He lowers the axe and stares at it, as though unsure how it got there. I look at him closely. "I think he's sleepwalking," I say. "Sergey, why don't you put the nice axe down? There you go. Easy does it. Right down on the floor. That's it." Ari takes the axe gently away while I coax Sergey back into bed. "There you go. Gently does it." "Let's tie his ankles," Ari suggests. "Sweet dreams, Sergey," I whisper as I tighten the ropes. "Christ almighty," Ari says, climbing in beside me. "He could have killed us." "Yeah," I shrug. "Something will eventually get us. I'm thinking of the rats or the police." "Even still," Ari says, "we should probably keep him tied up at night." So we do. We try to get rid of him. At first, we suggest we need some privacy, you know, as a couple. He doesn't seem to understand. Then I tell him my father is visiting. Sergey says he'd be very pleased to meet him. We suggest it's getting a little crowded with the three of us, to which Sergei says, but we're almost blood. We're not, I tell him firmly. But still, he won't leave. He threatens to put a hex on us if we try to force him out. With each passing day, Sergei's religious mania reaches new heights. Today, a week after he first moved in, he decides to recreate a Russian Orthodox service. Come on, he says, wearing a black robe dredged from God knows where. Ari and I follow him up the stairs and through the trapdoor, holding hands. His cassock brushes the dusty steps. Ari looks afraid. When we reach the top, I can see he has pushed the iconostasis to the side and is standing in the sanctuary, hands raised to the crumbling ceiling. He is singing in some Slavic liturgical language, howling and stamping his boots on the faded carpet. I suddenly feel very afraid. Is this for real? Ari asks. I think we should humor him, I say, sitting down on a pew. Stand up, he commands. Are you infirm? Christ, I jump up, flushed. We stand silently, listening to Sergei sing in a deep baritone. Pacing the sanctuary, he swings a smoking eucalypt branch side to side in a parody of a once familiar ritual, a conflation of multiple traditions. Come, time for the wine, he announces. We bow our heads and wait our turn. I don't want to drink from his cup, Ari whispers. Remember the axe, I say. What is this stuff? Ari asks. The blood of Christ, Sergei says solemnly. On our way out, Sergei tears up a strip of lavash bread. Isn't it supposed to be leavened bread, I ask. You want to bake some? He makes a good point. We bow in thanks. After you, he says, and follows us down the stairs. When Sergei goes out one morning, Ari announces, enough is enough. He's got to go, I agree. Meow Meow lollops over and sits on my feet. I get the sense she doesn't much like Sergei either. He's too erratic for her, singing liturgies one minute, screaming and murderous the next. We decide to give him another week, and then we will kill him. It's regrettable, really, but ethics are for those at the top of Maslow's hierarchy. The only thing that stumps us is method. We pace around the dusty basement, from the hallway sink to the fireplace, back and forth, thinking but also keeping warm. Arsenic, Ari suggests. To 19th century Britain. Gun? To Chicago, not to mention messy. Well, why don't you suggest something, Shell? I propose botulism. People die of it all the time, from eating jams and pickles bought at market stalls decades ago. No one would suspect a thing. Not that the police would trouble with the likes of us, but Sergei's relatives might, if they come looking. I know a woman, Ari says. Who? She specializes in the deadly bacterium, is all Ari will say. On the fateful day, I cook dinner, laying out three plates, the one with the chipped edge for Sergei. His green beans come from a poorly sealed jar. Thank you, he says, as I pass it to him. I almost feel bad then. Ari looks at me sternly. You have to be all in, they'd said early. I watch Sergei chew, forcing food into my mouth so as not to alarm him. We are sitting on upturned milk crates around a milk crate coffee table. You make do with what you have. When glitter was banned for environmental reasons in 2025, people threw the stuff out. I decorated the crates with glitter glue love hearts and stars. Where's our next source of wood coming from? Sergei asks. Stanmore. There are a few stumpy trees left there, Ari says. How far? Not too far. We'll carry it piece by piece while one of us stands guard. Those rough sleepers are hungry and mean. Millennials, mostly. Global disaster smooths out class differences, though, at least after a certain point, so lots of rich folks are out scavenging, too. I keep shoving forkfuls of nettles into my mouth while Ari tries to keep the conversation light. Sergei volunteers to do the dishes. Oh, thank you, I say, alarmed. He's never once done the dishes since he moved in. I cast a glance at Ari, who shrugs. I feel really guilty now. I move my milk crate closer to Ari and whisper, Did we just make a terrible mistake? Ari tells me to shut it. I close my eyes and listen to the clang of dishes. Sergei is singing a Cossack lullaby, elbows deep in water. And then, in the middle of the night, it starts. Sergei is screaming. I race over to his cardboard bed and, kneeling down, untie his ankles. "You okay?" I ask, knowing full well that he's dying. "Ugh," he says. Ari shines the torch on his face. His eyelids are droopy, facial muscles slack. "Ugh," he says again. Ari catches my eye. "Fresh air," they suggest. I know they just don't want a mess in here. We support Sergei under the arms and help him out the basement window. He vomits right over the ledge. We push his bum up and over and climb out after him. He slumps down against the weatherboard wall and I squeeze his floppy hand. He vomits again. The sky is purple velvet. The only sounds are the long-haul trucks chugging along Cleveland. Meow Meow settles on my lap. "It'll be over soon," Ari says gently. They are never normally gentle. He swings his head wildly from Ari to me, but I can tell his vision's shot, blurred, doubled. "You'll go to heaven," I tell him, squeezing his hand, "and get to drink all the kvass you want." He vomits at that. And then he slumps forward and convulses. By morning, he's dead. "Fuck," Ari says. "Fuck," I say back. Sergei was only the third person I ever killed. It really got to me. We wrap his body in a blue tarp and carry him through the gate to the backyard. Ari disappears, leaving me with the corpse. I keep watch, though against what, I don't know. When they come back, they're holding a pickaxe and two beanies. "Here," they say, handing me one. "It's -5 out." If we're honest, I can't see the point. So what if my ears freeze off? We take turns digging a Sergei-shaped hole in the quartz. It's hard going. The fig tree hadn't borne fruit in years, not since I was a kid, but we thought it'd be a nice gesture. I'd like to be buried under a tree, wouldn't you? We swing his body into the hole on the count of three. Ari doesn't falter once. The service is somber. We pour the goon in a cup and take swigs from it. I burn a eucalypt twig, and Ari says a Hail Mary. We thank St. Vladimir for the wine and the horses and for converting to Christianity. We each sprinkle a handful of dirt on Sergei's body. Then we stick a wild purple flower on the top. The cat pees on the heap. "I like to think we covered all our bases," Ari says. "I reckon we did." "Are you crying?" "I don't know. Maybe," I say, ducking away. At first, we are joyous. We sleep like babies, burn pews, we celebrate with leftover goon, we dance, we wake with hangovers, I make cream of broccoli soup, even Meow Meow seems happier. But then, just as suddenly, the dark shadows come alive at night. The light bulbs flicker on and off. Pink and purple dayglow spiders come out of their hidey holes. A cold gust sweeps through the basement. We try to stick it out, but we can't sleep, can't eat, can't shit. "We can't stay here," I say. "There's too much bad juju." Ari shakes their head, says, "We should have just moved in the first place, pet." Soon after, we abandon the improvised religion and pack up our things. Meow Meow follows us out the basement window, bouncing alongside us down Cleveland Street. "Where are we headed?" I ask Ari. "I know a place," they say. "Like you knew a woman." Ari puts an arm around me. "Shh," they say gently. Meow Meow jumps onto my shoulder. Up ahead at the intersection, there's an old studio with the words Urban Yoga, white against black, decidedly modern. The windows are blasted, but apart from that, it looks okay. It's still standing. I know immediately that this is the place. "Shall we go up?" I ask. We hold hands and take the narrow steps up to our new temporary home, our newest religion, Meow Meow leading the way.
That was Mark Desse reading St. Vladimir by Tanya Vavilova. Mark is currently living in Brooklyn, New York City, where he recorded St. Vladimir for us from his home studio. He was a regular performer in the live little fictions shows at Knox Street Bar Chippendale before heading off to the US to expand his acting experience on stage and on screen. Today's author, Tanya Vavilova, began creating works of literature with the intention of writing a memoir, but she tells Spineless Wonders that she eventually tried her hand at short stories, which developed from realistic narratives of her own life to more surreal and outlandish stories that we find in her collections. Tanya finds it easier to write memoir when she is feeling rather dreary, but fiction writing comes easily when she is more upbeat. Tanya's beautiful writing has developed from deeply personal experiences of phobias, anxieties, as well as from her background working with university students as a case manager. Love and intimacy form the basis of most of Tanya's writing. They sit there as undertones to what is happening in the world outside her characters' homes and experiences. Writing for Archer magazine, Tanya explains that at times she finds it challenging to get into the head of her characters and write how they experience love, imagining how her characters might give themselves to someone else. Tanya mixes personality traits, lives, habits, and mannerisms of those around her, including herself, to form her stories. She also likes to question the effects of the changing ecosystem and politics of the world around us. What did you think of St. Vladimir? While it does paint a particularly difficult future for humans, it also shows love and resilience as well as some hope. The characters care for one another and, in their own way, try to make their problematic life feel as normal as they can. St. Vladimir forms a part of a collection of short stories by Tanya titled Grub, published by Spineless Wonders, and it can be found on the Spineless Wonders website. And that's all we have time for today. I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. Little Fictions on Air is produced by Bronwyn Meehan. The production assistant is Caddy Hansen. I'm Kate Liston-Mills. Please join me again for Little Fictions on Air. Hey.